I forgot to tell you, I got this off the internet. It's you know how I'm a like reality show junkie. You know, I don't know why. I'm into Fear Factor. I love Survivor. Go Stephanie on team. Go Stephanie. She's the only one left on that team. It's going to be a bloodbath. But I love that kind of stuff. I love Amazing Race. Well, yeah, I just got this. The Fox Network has just announced its new reality TV show called One Night Stand. It features a handsome and eligible bachelor who happens to own a multi-billion-dollar company overseas. The producers admit that this is pushing the limits of reality TV, but so far, press has been positive. 10 lucky girls have been selected to receive extreme makeovers that will prepare them for meeting the young man. After much preparation, they will have one night and one night only to make a lasting impression in any way she knows how. After all 10 girls have spent the night with him, he will have the difficult choice of making one of them his bride based on how she did and, of course, how she looks. To level the playing field, all the girls chosen have had no prior sexual experience. This will be their first time. Because of all the buzz generated in England, they are beginning the process of taping another season. All interested applicants can log on to the Fox Network website to receive more information. What do you think? How do you like that show? Anyone going to send your daughters over there? To? No, it's not April Fool's. It's not April Fool's, but it is true. I completely made this up. You thought this was real, huh? This actually could have been real. The only reason why I made this stuff up is because this is the premise of Esther chapter 2. I'm not in the habit of titling my sermons, but if I were going to title this sermon, it would be The Dark Side of Esther. Esther chapter 2 happens to be what I think is some of the worst morality in all of the Bible. Now, Genesis has a bunch of it. The book of Judges has a bunch of it as well. But Esther chapter 2 is horrible. Now, I listened to three pastors treat Esther chapter 2. None of them, I am convinced none of them read the chapter. I am convinced. No, okay, sorry, I take that back. I'm convinced they read the chapter, but I'm also convinced they did not understand what was going on in Esther chapter 2. Now, hopefully, you've read through this. And the biblical account, I will admit, softens a lot of the stuff. We read it and we just think, oh, no big deal. But really, when you start getting down into the nitty-gritty of the details, this is some difficult stuff. Yes, if you need to escort your child to kids' church or Jesus time, you're more than welcome to do that, because this stuff is going to be just... I'm sorry about this, and I hadn't anticipated until all of a sudden after I studied it, I'm like, whoa, this might have a PG-13 rating on it. And my deepest apologies, because I know I love having kids in here and all that stuff. If some adults need to go to kids' church and Jesus time. Whoa, I tell you, this is some tough stuff. This is the dark side of Esther. I'm going to go through it. I'm going to try not to, you know, lay out any sort of details, but I want you to understand this. We've been lied to. I've been lied to. When I studied the book of Esther, and I've been told about the book of Esther, I'm told about this amazing, wonderful woman named Esther and her faithful and filled with integrity cousin named Mordecai, and how they stood in the face of danger and in the face of extermination, and they kept their integrity and kept their maturity and kept their morality. And again, when I listened to the pastors, all of them said that exact same thing. The problem is, that is not what took place in the book of Esther. That's not what happens. Esther is not this incredible moral person that you might come to imagine. Let's go through this text. There is a meaning behind this. So you just keep in mind, this Fox reality show, it wouldn't be too far off from the biblical account. Now, also, I promise you, after Esther chapter 2, for all those that had to take their kids away, the rest of the book is relatively clean. At least that's what I'm picking up so far. And it just tells, it's actually a very humorous story. A lot of twists and turns, a lot of irony that ends up in it. And it would make a great dramatic presentation one of these times. But Esther 2, this is kind of the hitch and the giddy up. This is some, I wasn't anticipating this, really. So, Esther chapter 2. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. I should also note that 4 years have passed between chapter 1 and chapter 2. We just know this from secular history. What happened in those 4 years? Remember the big party that Xerxes was throwing? That was in order to prepare everyone for this huge, massive invasion of the only unconquered territory at that time, and that was Greece. And Greece had to put up a fight. And Greece was vastly outnumbered, something like 1 million troops to 100,000 troops. It was going to be just a slaughter. That's why they had prepared and they were all drunk and crazy and going to go down there and take care of business. Well, the problem was they got down to one crucial battle, and they were able in this one battle to bottleneck the Persian army into this small area, and then they fought them off one by one and sent the Persians packing. They even, the Greek historian Herodotus said that 10 Persian men equaled the equivalent of the skill of one Grecian man. That's how sophisticated the Greeks were in their fighting. That's how good they were. So they went down to take over Greece, did not get the job done, and so were sent off and sent back. So now essentially King Xerxes is licking his war wounds. He comes home from the fight, and he's like, all I need is just a little loving in my life. He's looking forward to seeing the woman, a home-cooked meal. That's really great. He gets back and realizes, oh, that's right. I dumped her already. I forgot. Yeah, Queen Vashti's gone, and I decreed that she could no longer come into my presence. And remember, this was an irrevocable decree. When they write it in the laws of the Medes and the Persians, these laws were irrevocable. So it's not like he could come back and say, I miss you, Vashti. I really want you to come back. I just forget what I'd said before. Come back to me. He couldn't because it was an irrevocable law. So he's kind of sad. He's probably moping around the palace like a grumpy, defeated, pride-ridden man. And his personal attendants have come up with an idea. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search on the Fox network be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Okay, now I'm sorry, I'm going to offend your sensibilities one more time. The word there, virgin, really actually means a female of marriageable age, almost exclusively entailed that she be a virgin, which means she was about 13 years old. That's the age. Sorry. I won't bring that up again because I know. So, let the search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. It's an extreme makeover. Then let the girl who pleases the king, that's a euphemism, I don't need to go into that, be queen instead of Vashti. Here's the most obvious sentence in the Bible. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now, this is a brutal society, and so females were taken, often against their will, but in this case, it was probably an extreme honor to be brought in because you had a chance, a one in maybe, we get the idea of maybe 300 to 500 girls, so you had a one in 500 chance in order to become queen. That's pretty good odds. That's pretty good. Now, before you start saying, all you women rising up and saying, this is horrible, this mean society to women, I don't know. I don't know which is worse, to be a young boy or a young female in this society, because at this time we're also told that about 500 boys were rounded up and they became eunuchs at the same time. So I don't know which is worse. I I personally think it's a guy thing, but that's, I think, because I'm a guy, you know? What do you think, Chris? Well, because that's how they keep people from trying to ascend to the throne. If you were my kingdom and I wanted to make sure none of you could threaten my throne, if I made you a eunuch, you could no longer have children. If you didn't have children, you couldn't have a dynasty, and so you would give up the fight, so to speak, on doing that. So that's how these poor young guys are taken and yowzers. Now, should I say that for the tape? Should I say that for the tape? That this is a eunuch experience? Well, gosh. Thank you, Joe. Now we get introduced to another character in this whole thing. I'm sorry, we haven't actually been introduced to Esther or to Mordecai. Now, there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shammai, the son of Kish. It's not that he had a lot of fathers. This is a successive. This is a line of people. Now, if you were a good Jewish person, you would say to yourself, because you know the Old Testament so well, you would go, wasn't there another guy that had the same lineage? And you would go ask your rabbi, and the rabbi would say, well, of course, all you have to do is look at 1 Samuel, and you will find out that there was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah of Benjamin. He had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any of the others. This is King Saul of the Old Testament, of the fight between Saul and David. He was made king because the Israelites were begging for a king so badly, and God had David in mind the whole time, but the Israelites jumped the gun and said, no, we want him now. And so he said, fine, you want a king, I'll give you a king, here's Saul. And it was just a horrible, horrible disaster. So this is setting up something. I'm just preparing for it, because in the next chapter we're going to be introduced to another guy by the name of Haman, and we're going to get his lineage. And you're going to find out that there is a battle between these two lineages. I bring it up now, but we'll spend a lot more time with that next week. Now it's interesting. We got this guy named Mordecai, and we got this girl, let me read the next thing, who'd been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Now, the reason why that's mentioned is Jehoiachin was part of the nobility and part of the first deportation, which leads us all to believe that Mordecai was part of a royal family in some way, shape, or form. He was one of the higher ups. Now, we don't know exactly how Esther fits into this whole thing in terms of what her family was all about, but we know that Mordecai was. Now, Mordecai and Esther is very interesting. These were their Babylonian names. We don't know Mordecai's original name, but we're going to be told that Esther's original name was Hadassah. Now, Mordecai comes from the god called Marduk. And not Marmaduke, Marduk. And Marduk, and there was another, the female version of Marduk was the goddess of love and war. Her name was Ishtar. So interestingly enough, Esther and Mordecai have not only taken on Babylonian names, they've taken on Babylonian names of the pagan gods. You're getting the idea here? Remember, they aren't even supposed to be there. Remember, the edict of Cyrus has already been decreed that all the Jews can return to Jerusalem. If you were a good Jewish person, you would have already left. But for some reason, Mordecai, Esther have not returned. That's not good. And they've taken on these pagan god names. Very interesting. Now, some people have suggested that Mordecai and Esther are kind of, like code words, that they really weren't their real names. I find that hard to believe because we find Mordecai, that name actually seemed to be pretty popular. In the list of the exiles that return into Jerusalem, there is a Mordecai mentioned in Ezra chapter 2, verse 2, in company with Zerubbabel as he goes back, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Reliah, and Mordecai, and all these other weird names. And Nehemiah gives the exact same, a couple of different things, but he lists the same people along with Mordecai as well. So Mordecai was a real name, and it was real people. Now, this was not the Mordecai we're talking about here. This is a Mordecai that left and went back to Jerusalem. This Mordecai sticks around. All right. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. We're not told what happened to father and mother. Remember that a lot of these people were killed. So we are led to believe that this could be a royal thing, that it could be a nobility issue, but we just don't know. We just know that she is an orphan. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So Mordecai adopts Esther and is raising her as his own child. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. Now, those words, brought to the citadel, put under, and also Esther was taken, these are very aggressive Hebrew words. It could mean, this is not definitive, this could mean that she was taken against her will. A lot of people will try and bring that up to say, look, Esther is just caught up in a scenario, in a situation she has no control over, and she's just doing the best that she can. I can concede that, but there comes a problem a little bit later on. Don't think that Esther is some, you know, hoity-toity, you know, wonderful integrity type person that has no foibles whatsoever. Now, just because those are aggressive words doesn't mean that that's exactly what happened. Again, to become the king, the queen of all Persia is a very big honor indeed. So for some of these, it would be just like a reality show going on to a bachelor type thing. They really want to win, even though there's 20 other girls competing for the same affection. I've never understood that. I am surprised. I think, isn't the only couple left in The Bachelor, Tristan and Ryan? Everyone else broke up. I wonder why. I mean, guys, you couldn't live up to that, could you? You couldn't live up to all the helicopter dates and, you know, having Norah Jones sing to you. You know, these are great dates. You know, the next time you go out on a date, there's no cameraman following you, no sound guy with a little boom mic going, okay, speak into that, and no one flipping out their Visa card and paying for your dates. It's all of a sudden you're going to McDonald's, and the woman's really not very impressed anymore. But that's what's happening here. They are all being brought to the king. Let me say another thing. I was tempted to do this with my reality show one-night stand, but Heather said that you would have probably figured it out by then. What happens if in this reality show it comes out that the winner was a Christian and she just hid her identity because her family said, don't do it because you probably won't be chosen? So, and there might be some backlash against it, so hide the fact that you are Christian. And what happens if that girl won? What would the Christian community do? Yeah. Now, this is exactly what happens. Again, putting it in contemporary language helps us understand exactly what's going on here. This is some interesting. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. So he says, keep it under wraps. Now we find out, for good reason, that there is, again, a big hatred amongst the Persians for the Jewish people, and the head of that is going to be this guy named Haman, who's going to get introduced in chapter 3. And so it could have been a protection thing. Don't say anything. But in the least, we've got a lot of problems, because as a good Jewish person, how in the world are you going to hide this fact? That means you would have to break pretty much every commandment known in the Torah in order to do this. You couldn't worship on the Sabbath. You couldn't try and keep yourself in the dietary laws. You couldn't essentially say your prayers. because the second you mention Yahweh's name, everyone's going to find out who you are. So Esther, now, again, this is where the controversy lies. Was she doing it for her own safety, or was she doing it so she would win? Again, if you want to try and make Esther as good as possible so that she can become a role model for you, well, first of all, don't do that in the first place. But if you're tempted to do that, you can say she did it for her own protection. Paul mentions this. I don't have a PowerPoint verse, Rich. Don't worry. Paul mentions this as he says, if you get persecuted in one place, flee to another. Some people say, oh, that's horrible. You know, you shouldn't, you know, stand in the face of persecution and fight the machine. Paul says that there's options, that there are times when you may have to flee because of persecution. Yes. Oh, yeah, we'll get to those. Yeah, what happened to the 499 others? I tell you, except, no, they didn't die. They didn't. That's what's so amazing about it. Death wasn't imminent as if you didn't win. You did. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, it wasn't as if you lose the competition, boom, you know, you're dead. No, well, I don't know which is worse. Maybe it would have been good to die. You essentially just become a part of the king's harem. You become what's called a concubine. That's not a little prickly, you know, person. That's a porcupine. Concubine. A concubine is just a female who, yeah, a sex slave. That's exactly what it is. Just sits around all day long, and when the king, you know, walks in and goes, you 7, you 7:15, you 7:30, you know, that's how it would work. And well, yeah, I've given him a lot of credit. What can I say? I don't know. I don't know how Xerxes is, but we're moving on. We're moving on. Yeah. Verse 12, this is where we get the description. Now again, when you read this, this sounds rather innocuous. Sounds rather innocent. But I think this is the way that the writer is just trying to lay the information out without getting into some really nasty details. But you could get the picture right from what's being spoken of here. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. Talk about an extreme makeover. I mean, this is a 12-month process. And they've actually uncovered some of these jars where apparently what they did, now we can't verify this, but people have speculated that these jars were like incense burners and they would just kind of stand over them with their clothes and it's almost like fumigating a house, I guess. And it would just come in and they would be in that oily stuff and they would become very oily themselves. And they would do that for 6 months. I thought it took a long time for my wife to get ready. 6 months for just the perfume and 6 months for the cosmetics. Holy cow. So, now, does Esther object to any of this stuff? Is she saying, I will not participate in such a pagan thing? I'm beautiful on the inside. Nope, she doesn't. And this, verse 13, and this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. Now, we don't know what, some of the stuff is so vague, we're not quite sure exactly what, you know, is it a negligee? Is it, you know, a Zorro mask? Is it, you know, a little funny beanie hat? I don't know what it is that she brought. But if she wanted to bring anything to meet the king, she could bring that with her. Yeah, I agree. In the evening, she would go there and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Shazbat, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. So if you were brought into this beauty contest, if you didn't win, you just simply had to hang out with 400 other girls. Granted, you were treated very nicely. You had everything at your disposal. You had all the food, all the wine, all the... This is Hugh Hefner's little palace, you know? That's essentially what it is. That's all it is. It's just a little mansion that you stay in, and on occasion the king would come in, choose a couple people, and then you would go off with him, but that's only if he summoned you by name. So that's how this competition is working. You got one night, One night only. This is the one night stand. You gotta stand out among 300 to 500 other girls. Yeah, and so the odds are against her. This is not a good competition because, you know, she's going to have to break a lot of rules to get to the top. Verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem, suggested. Well, what was that? We have no idea. Haggai suggested something. She said, sounds good, and went in. Do you feel a little uncomfortable reading this now that I set it up that way? I should have just read it first, because then you'd be like, oh, this is such a nice little story. And then we could have, well, okay. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So, right there is the death knell to Esther is just, you know, a hapless victim in circumstances. She didn't protest. She didn't put up a fight. She pleased him more than any other girl did. Not looking too good for Esther, huh? You don't want to be like Esther anymore. Hey, you wanted to name your kid Esther, didn't you? Yes, Stephen. They had ways to verify that. They could, but there was always you usually had a bloody sheet afterwards. That's how they would verify it. That's back in those days, that's how you verify. That's what the job of the best man actually was in a wedding. Yeah, you don't want to be a best man now, do you? Your job would be to wait. They would actually consummate the marriage right in front of, not in front of, but behind closed doors, but while everyone was still partying outside, and then the best man's job was to go in, grab the sheets, and bring them out to verify, yes, she was, in fact, a virgin, and, you know, and the marriage has now been consummated. Yeah. So that's, yeah. So that's how they verified it. Sure, I'm sure that maybe some could have lied, but not very likely. Yes, Amy. Yeah, bed sheets. Yeah. Yeah. So, how do you like Esther so far? Isn't this a fabulous book? Aren't you just, you know, impressed with the courage of Queen Esther? Aren't you impressed with Mordecai and the stuff that he says? You know, let me finish this up, because I got a very important point to make about this. Verse 18. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. Before we get into verse 19, turn with me, if you can, to the book of Ezra. That's two books to the left, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Ezra chapter 10. Because something interesting is going on back in Jerusalem that corresponds with what's going on here in Babylonia. I'm just going to read this quickly. Ezra chapter 10. While Ezra was praying and confessing, weeping, and throwing himself down before the house of God, a large crowd of Israelites, men, women, and children gathered around him. They too wept bitterly. Then Shechaniah, son of Jehiel, one of the descendants of Elam, said to Ezra, "We have been unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women from the peoples around us. But in spite of this, there is still hope for Israel. Now let us make a covenant before our God to send away all these women and their children in accordance with the counsel of my Lord and of those who feared the commands of our God. Let it be done according to the law. Rise up. This matter is in your hands. We will support you. So take courage and do it." And sure enough, they did it. Ezra gave a decree out saying, if you married a foreign wife, divorce her and you can't keep the children. Send them back to their homeland. Children go with them. Now again, I'm not going to talk about the morality, whether it's right or wrong. I think we all kind of have a hint of what's going on. Isn't that right, Kim? We kind of have a hint of what's...
I was just wondering, because you're ragging on Ezra, or Esther, trying her best, and calling... She's not somebody we're supposed to look up to, but the guys can go ahead and abandon women and children.
Well, yeah, I'm not...
You aren't forced to marry these women and procreate.
Sure, I agree. They were told very specifically not to, but they did it anyway. Now, the question becomes, and all the commentators disagree, was this a good thing or not? I mean, this is exactly what the Catholic Church had to deal with the second it started allowing pastors from other faiths to come into their fold. If I, as a Lutheran pastor, decided, you know what, Luther was smoking some weird stuff, and the Catholics are all right, and I really love Mary a whole lot, I'm going to become a Catholic priest. Well, the problem is, Catholic priests are not allowed to be married. So what do I do with Heather and the kids? Send them off. Boom. Nah, no. That's why the Catholic Church has made an agreement that if you come into the Catholic Church as a priest already married, they will not compound the sin by having them do that. I highlight this, Kim, for just the sheer purpose of what do you think Ezra thought of Queen Esther? Could Ezra be thinking of Queen Esther the same way we would think of a Christian hiding her identity and going on this Fox reality show one night stand? Now, this is where it gets messy, doesn't it? Because what do we do with this stuff? Who's right and who's wrong? There is a very important reason why the writer of the book of Esther does not say anything else about who's right or wrong. Is just simply reporting the facts. This is the important piece. You've got to catch this, if nothing else. You will always have problems with the book of Esther if you don't catch this. Esther is not trying to preach morality. It is trying to show how God can use, usually behind the scenes, very imperfect and flawed people. At the least, we could say that Esther lost some of her integrity somewhere along the way. She didn't live up and stand up to her belief system, right? We can at least say that. Was in the face of extreme circumstances? Sure. But if nothing else, that one night, she was better than 500 other girls. That alone should have us go, maybe Esther's not doing this out of all pure motives. What this is highlighting is what the same thing happens with David when we get to Bathsheba. Now, with the story of David and Bathsheba, we're told specifically the Lord was not pleased with this. Oh, good. At least we got some standard here that we know that God frowns upon certain things. But isn't it interesting that through the royal line of David, the Messiah was supposed to come? Does this mean this gives us license to say, oh, God uses flawed people? Woohoo! Yeah, baby, I'm going to go have some fun, and I want to see what God can make out of the mess that I make. No, of course not. No, don't do that. That's not what it's supposed to be. But it does cause us to step back and maybe pull back a little of our criticism of people that we might not like a whole lot. Anyone here watch American Pie, American Pie 2, and American Wedding? Anyone watch any of those? Oh, I can't believe that. That's such a pagan film. What's wrong with you? No. I've actually never seen it, but isn't it true? It's just about, free sex, just have fun, kids just going out and, being crazy, so to speak. One of the characters in there, his name is Kevin, was played by a guy, his name is Thomas Ian Nicholas. He starred in a bunch of other films. He's actually really good friends with Kate Winslet, because he starred together with her in A Kid in King Arthur's Court. And it was really funny because he had opportunity to even talk with Kate when she was filming some of the stuff on the Titanic, and how Kate would even call him up and say that, I almost died today in one of the scenes because I had these weights to get the image that I was going down, and there was divers all around with, masks ready to save me when I needed it. But let me tell you, it was still really scary when it happened. You might be saying to yourself, how in the world did you get all this information about good old Thomas Ian Nicholas and Kate Winslet? Well, I actually had a chance to sit down and have drinks with Thomas Ian Nicholas. It was a strange coincidence. Heather was in charge of this gathering called Bridging the Gap, and one of the people that they brought on was this guy named Thomas Ian Nicholas. And he had started his own band called the Tin Men, T-I-N, Thomas Ian Nicholas, came from his name, and he sings lead vocal and plays the guitar. And so I'm sitting down to have drinks with this guy before he's about to do his concert, and I'm talking to him all about his belief system, what he believes. He comes from a Lutheran church, very, very, very strong Christian, very outspoken especially in Rolling Stones magazine. I actually read that interview, as he talks about his faith in Jesus Christ. Now, what do you think the nice Christian community thought of good old Thomas Ian Nicholas? How in the world could a strong Christian star in a movie that has just such horrible things? I even asked him that question. His response, it's hard. It's hard because I know what people are thinking about me, that I'm giving up my morality and not standing for what I believe by playing roles that should portray Christian values. Then, after reading the Book of Esther, you go, gosh, what should I be thinking? What should I be doing? Same thing happened as I got a chance. How do you guys like my new microphone, by the way? Is this cool? Sorry, it's bugging me because it keeps sliding like this, and so I have to keep pushing it back. I got to use some tape or something, I guess. Got to keep it there. But a guy helped me out fitting this. His name is Chad Griswold. He ran sound for us a couple of times, and I went to him and was talking with him, and I said, so how's the touring go? Because he tours. And he says, it's great, but everything's a disco song. And I said, a disco song? What are you talking about? He says, I'm touring with Casey and the Sunshine Band. I'm like, oh, wow, that's really great. How long have you been doing that? He says, 2 years. I said, 2 years? I thought you were touring with Jackie Velasquez. He goes, yeah, I was for a while, but then it kind of stopped. I said, really? Now, if you don't know Jackie Velasquez, she was a very strong Christian artist, very good, won a lot of awards, was just touring around doing all these great things. But one of her big loves was she wanted to make it into the movies. So she starred in the movie. I forgot to look it up, what movie it was. She starred in a movie where there's this one guy who is dating three women at the same time, and through some fluke that only Hollywood can produce, all three girls end up in this guy's apartment at the same time in three separate bedrooms, all getting ready in their own special way. What was that? Chasing Poppy, thank you. See, I knew if I talked long enough, someone would figure it out. And she was one of the girls that came. And then they all three in this big dramatic moment pop out and are there in their nighttime clothes, so to speak. One of them, apparently, rather provocatively dressed. Another one more of in kind of a elegant nightgown. And there's Jackie Velasquez in shorts and a T-shirt. And Chad says, that's what killed her career. I said, what? Said, yeah, she can no longer tour as a Christian artist because no one would come to her concerts. Her concerts dried up. No Christian would go watch it because she starred in that movie. Now, what am I supposed to do with this? I mean, is that right? Should you stand up for your morals and your principles? Can you be a part of such a thing? What do we do with the Book of Esther? Esther is not doing things quite right. She's in a beauty contest. What do I say to Christian females that want to enter beauty contest? Should we? Should we not? I guess all this is to say, I don't have an easy answer. This is something I'm struggling with myself. I don't know how to come down on this side because Esther is just so vague. And I know we haven't gotten to the good stuff yet. We haven't gotten to the part where God miraculously, through everything lining up exactly the way it's supposed to be, uses Esther in the most powerful and amazing way possible to preserve the Jewish race and prevent their extinction. Yeah. So what do I say? Go ahead, live like Esther. God can use that. Or do I not? How much do we stand up? Again, this is not for you to say, how should I? You should live your life the way the Bible calls you to. But there are going to be times through false motives or impure actions that you will not live up to God's standard. Everyone at that point usually says, I'm out. God can't use me. It's impossible. He can never use me. Though God never condones actions that are contrary to His will, to His law, He can still use them for powerful things. I think it was J. Vernon McGee. I read this quote, and I thought this kind of helped me out. It's almost as if Esther and Mordecai are on second base. They're not really where they're supposed to be. They're kind of out of God's will, and they're not really watching the base coaches, but hopefully God's going to get them home, back to where he's supposed to be. That helped me out. That helped me out because I've done it too. I think we've all done it. Outside of God's will, how can God use us? it also causes me to step back and say, gosh, could God use Monica Lewinsky? A couple years ago, I would have said, heck no, are you kidding? May she burn in hell, that heathen woman. It was all her fault. Well, no, I think Bill took a lot of responsibility himself. But the question is, can God use that for good? Sure. Does that mean you should go out and become a Monica Lewinsky? No, heaven forbid. But just know that if you made mistakes in your life, even grave ones, God could use it. We see that in David. We see that in Jeremiah, Isaiah. All the big guns have sorted past. This also, I believe, is a huge authentication that the Christian faith is real. You know, you read other books, you read other literature from other faith systems, and isn't it amazing that everyone does everything right? You know, Joseph Smith, can you say anything bad about Joseph Smith? I mean, he's venerated all over the place. He never stumbles once. What about Buddha? Never, not once. He's just incredible. No mistakes recorded whatsoever. You can't have the people of your faith making mistakes. The Bible. If you want to read a book that has no controversy in it, don't read the Bible. Because the Bible is full of how God uses people messing up like you and me for His great purposes. That makes it real. Everything else is untouchable. Everything else I can never live up to. But here the Bible says He can use me. And that's what makes it wonderful. Catch it. You got to get this, you know. Yeah. I'm sorry. I wish I was so tempted to preach like a really nicey sermon, and I could have, you know, talked about standing strong in the face of all this difficulty, and I could have just taken the easy way out, and I really wanted to, trust me. But I'm going to treat this text like it's, I think, supposed to be treated. We're going to look at it. We're going to look at it hard. And we're going to wrestle with some difficult questions. Questions that I don't have the answers to. Which means you need to figure it out as well. You need to struggle with this. What do you do with Esther? All right. So there's the setup. All of this really is for the sole purpose of getting Esther into the queenship. Vashti's gone. Esther is now the queen. And this becomes very important. Every plot point is very important. Let's keep going. And we'll finish up chapter 2. Mordecai uncovers a conspiracy. Dun, dun, dun. When the virgins were assembled a second time, which causes us lots of problems because I thought a queen was already chosen. Apparently this king liked to do this as a, you know, part-time gig. So he does it again. Assembles a bunch of virgins and does it a second time. How'd you like that, Esther? How'd you like to be queen in that type of scenario? Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. This tells us that Mordecai was in some way, shape, or form part of the upper echelon. He was upper management in the king's palace. It sounds like he was a judge. Now, don't get the idea that this is nepotism going on. Esther did not get Mordecai that job. And I could prove that when we hit the later chapters, because Mordecai and Esther are still hiding their identity and hiding the fact that they even know each other. So it's not like Esther's up, oh, you know what, there's a vacancy, you know, on the Secretary of Defense. Why don't you choose Mordecai? He's really good. No, Mordecai got to that position all on his own. Yes, Amy. Yeah, Ezra and Esther... Ezra is in charge of the people that have returned to Jerusalem to rebuild it. And then Esther takes place in between Ezra chapter 6 and 7, where some of the Jews decided to stay back and not return to Jerusalem. And Esther is the story of two of those people, and also many others of the Jewish people that decided to stick around Babylonia. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. And I guess this is where I'm supposed to pontificate about, you know, kids, listen to your parents, but there's no kids here, so that's really helpful. Yeah. No, again, I don't get into the morality issue on this one. Esther is not a moral book. I can't bring out moral things to do or not to do because it just gets too messy and sticky. All we know is that Esther is a good, obedient little girl, and she still follows the advice of Mordecai. I even heard one pastor talk about how horrible, what a sin that was, because the second she got married, She should have been listening to the directions and instructions of the king, not to cousin Mordecai. And then he went off on Genesis chapter 2, you know, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, right? And the two shall become one. Oh, man. Again, who do you defend? Is Esther doing right by this or is she doing wrong by this? I don't know. And the Bible's not telling us which is the right way. All we know is that that's what she was doing, right or wrong. This is what happened. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana, he was, yeah, and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. A plot is afoot. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. So she gets wind of it. You know, that Mordecai finds out about the assassination. Don't ask me how. Was he just in the right place at the right time? Did he, you know, intercept some emails that, you know, had death threats in them? I don't know what happened. All we know is Mordecai figures it out. And he doesn't go to the king. He goes to the queen because he obviously knows the queen. Says, hey, someone's going to kill the king. And she goes, okay. She goes and tells the king, but Queen Esther doesn't take credit for it. She simply says Mordecai was the one to do that. Why is this important? Oh, it's very important. This is part of the huge plot line of the whole thing, because we find out, it's not spoken here, we find out Mordecai receives no reward. He just saved the king's life, and he gets nothing. Right? It happens to you a lot. You do something nice for someone else, you do something great at work, and someone else gets promoted ahead of you. Or things happen in your family and everyone credits your sister or your brother for doing this. He's like, wait, no, it was me that did it. Mordecai gets no reward and he makes no fuss about it. Why? Well, the theological answer is it's not his turn yet. Theological answer is everything is happening exactly according to God's will, because his reward will come, but later. That's big. Okay. So Mordecai uncovers this thing. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. It wasn't hanging like, you know, a rope and a noose and stuff like this. You were impaled on a stick. Yeah, it was like, you know, assassins, yeah, hot dog on a stick. It's assassin on a stick. Now, all this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. So the king knew it. The king knew who stopped it, but for some reason, some coincidence, it's not rewarded at this time. Also, just for your information, two assassins did finally kill him in 456 BC, but that comes in later. Chapter 3, we're not getting into it, you know, don't sweat, too bad. Esther chapter 3, we get introduced to the final character in this whole thing. And his name is Haman. And so next week, what I invite you to do, we'll do it like the Jewish people do on Purim, that at the sound of Haman's name, you can all boo and hiss. It's like an old melodrama. That's exactly how they would do it. You would don't drink until you're drunk and can't understand Mordecai be praised and Haman be cursed. But you know, when I mention Haman's name next week, you can all boo and hiss, and we'll practice it a couple. It'll sound cool on a CD, I think. So all of this recorded, all of this ready. Now, I don't know, maybe, you know, today was a really good sermon. I'm deeply apologetic. I have no great words of inspiration for you. I have no exciting news to give you, except for the fact that God uses, can I say the word, I'm sorry, screw-ups like you and I, in order to accomplish his will. And that's important. None of you, I repeat, none of you have been disqualified from ministry for anything that you have done in the past. You are still all very eligible to be used by God in a very powerful way. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that the Bible is controversial. It gives me good stuff to talk about, and it doesn't make it clean and neat, because I know that's not my life, and I know that's not anyone's life sitting here. But I know we are all very tempted to cry out against what's happening, cry out against Esther and Mordecai for the things that they're doing. And yet, nothing is being said, and we don't know how to react. And we have the same problem when we see Christians as actors or as politicians or as lawyers. We want to cry out sometimes, hey, where's your morals? And yet, even when people are outside your will, you can still use them in amazing ways and help us never to count them out, but to continue to pray for people to just be used by you, to come to know you fully, to conform their life as best as they know how through the power of your Spirit, to come into a much better relationship with you. And then, Lord, take everything else and just do your thing. Just bring some good from it. Lord, I praise you for Esther, even though I question her and I question Mordecai, but you used her in an incredible way. And Lord, that's how I would like to be used. In a way like no other. For something great. And I'll never be able to live up to any moral standard that anyone sets or you set. But may the cliche be true that you would work in spite of me. So we surrender our lives to you, Lord, thanking you that you can use broken and imperfect vessels, and that we would allow you to use us for good. In Jesus' name, amen.